This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, we got things to do, people to see, places to go. We don't have time to mess around. And this morning, as with every Thursday morning, is the Burning Platform. It is your chance to dip into current affairs and find out in the space of a, you know, good 30, 40 minutes, somewhere around there, everything you need to know so that you can be informed without having to listen to boring talk radio to get the information that you require. So we've got Ivo Fechter joining us this morning. Ivo writes for the Daily Maverick, among others. We've had him on before, and it's nice to talk to you, Ivo. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning, Gareth. Thanks for having me on.
Are you upsetting environmentalists this week or not so much?
I don't think I have this week. but that does make it a fairly unique week.
Yeah, I mean, usually you are unpredictable on these environmental issues. I've read a couple of the pieces you've written over the few months preceding this, and it seems to me sometimes you are absolutely dead center on environmental issues with all the tree huggers, and then on other issues, they look at themselves and go, what the hell? I thought he was our friend. You confuse people.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's confusing so much. You know, I care about the environment, obviously, and I think that there are some issues that really need to be resolved.
Right.
But I very often disagree with the way people go about resolving these. I don't agree with all the problems. I don't think that drinking straws are a crisis that are going to destroy the environment in a week, for example.
Yeah.
You know, but there's a lot of sort of statism in how people approach these things. Oh, we need to ban this, we need to ban that.
I generally
disagree with that.
Yeah. So, Ivo, let's get into a few of the things this week, because people are talking anyway, and we need to figure out what the most important conversations are and which ones we need to figure our way through. The first thing that raises its head this week is President Cyril Ramaphosa, who I don't know if it's ever a good idea for him to go off script, because he seems to he was certainly attempting in this case, and I'll get to the specifics of it in a minute. He was clearly attempting to win over a certain crowd. He was talking to a bunch of people who are farmers in Stellenbosch, I suppose. So it was mostly white people. It's part of his pre-election campaign drive in the Western Cape, where we know the ANC are having a tough time. They're not popular there, despite, you know, every attempt in every direction. He said South Africa is in the process of being fixed. His government could really be given a chance to correct past mistakes and address issues like corruption. So he's talking to a very specific audience. But then he said this, and I'd like your and Pumi's comments on this. He said South Africa needs all the skills it can get, and then said to all these young white people, he said, I don't want white young South Africans to leave the country. I quote, if I could, I would tie them to a tree and say, don't leave. I want you here in this country, so I want your skills. Close quotes.
Yeah, tying people to trees. That's interesting from someone who actually probably has the legal power to do so. Look, I think he faces a very real problem with the brain drain and with people fleeing the country. Mm. And you know, the way the economy is at the moment, it really is it's getting worse by the day, and there's hardly ever sort of good news coming out of the economy. So frankly, I'm not surprised that people with the means and the opportunity choose to leave. You know, they can earn more overseas, they've got fewer problems overseas, the economy is better overseas, there's more growth,
less tax.
You know, there's less tax. You know, things work overseas, and they just don't work in South Africa at the moment, or in most of South Africa at the moment. So I frankly can't blame anyone for wanting to leave. You know, what Ramaphosa has to do is not just appeal to them and say, oh, please don't leave. You know, I understand why he does that.
He needs to give people a reason.
That's not going to work. He actually needs to make actual changes and give them actual reasons to stay.
To me, this is a poverty of ideas. He clearly has run out of ideas that would make people want to voluntarily remain here, use their skills to improve their own lives and the lives of other people in South Africa. What he's really doing is saying, Ah, begrudgingly I need you. I mean, this doesn't make anyone feel wanted. Begrudgingly I need you because you pay tax and you can employ people because we know the government can't create jobs. So I'm going to say this because what I want is for you to feel placated. It's deeply patronizing this. I mean, can you imagine if he said that about women? If he said to women, we need women, I'll tie you to trees if I have to keep you here. I mean, there'd be outrage, and rightly so.
Yeah, no, indeed. Look, the thing is, you're right, it's a poverty of ideas. I mean, he keeps making promises. You know, he started this Sona last year and made a whole bunch of promises. You know, he had, the Youth Employment Agency that was supposed to employ 1 million people in 3 years or so, which employed, by the time Sona came around this year, it had created about 7,000 committed work experiences.
Which
whatever
is,
that means.
It's not jobs.
And of those, about 2,000 people are still employed in some capacity. Now, if you've got 3 years and you want to employ 1 million people, 2,000 in 1 year is not really a great record, is it?
No.
You know, and you can go down the list of promises he made in that Sona, you know, when everyone was sort of captured by Ramaphosa and so on. And they just haven't come true. They just don't deliver. And everything he has done, the economy hasn't really responded. I mean, the economy is looking worse than ever. And frankly, that Moody's still has us at investment grade is probably one of the puzzles for the ages.
So, you see, the thing for me about Cyril Ramaphosa, and I feel like every week, shame, I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
And the thing for me about it is that it's all populist speak, right? He talks to a particular audience and tells them what he thinks they want to hear.
Right.
Statistically, of the unemployment rates that we have in South Africa, young white people don't fall in that category. So they don't have that problem. They don't have the problem that young black people have, young black graduates have, because they make up a very small percentage of those who are unemployed. When it comes to people who want to leave this country, leave this country. People who have options leave. And in fact, at this moment where we talk about capital, that has already happened. Capital has already left. People who are investing in this country are people who invest in what emerging economies are. They are looking for this type of place to invest in. The downgrades by Moody's, all of those things are part of a sentiment that doesn't really apply to the individuals that he was speaking to over there. But the popular viewpoint, which is what he's appealing to, is that, oh, young white people are leaving in droves because there are no opportunities for them. If you look at payment, statistics in this country, who gets paid the most? Young white people get paid the most, even as they come in as interns, as compared to their black counterparts in terms of unemployment, they are more employed than their black counterparts.
Yeah.
So all of those things.
And they do more of the fears, they do more of the employing.
But you see, the fears that he is talking to, and this is what politicians are very good at doing, is they're very good at playing to the crowd that they're speaking to. And he does that extremely well.
No, I think he does it very poorly. In this particular example, he shows how absolutely shallow all of this is. If he was good at it, he would have been convincing. I don't think there's a single person in his target audience yesterday who bought one word of this bullshit. I mean, do you agree, Ivo?
No, I agree with that. You know, and that's the thing. They look at what he promises and what he says. And, you know, he's a good speaker. He's a charming fellow. He's smart, which certainly makes a big contrast with Jacob Zuma, who was a pretty crude and uneducated populist. So what he says sounds appealing, but then they look at the reality on the ground and they see that there's no progress being made. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, he says, oh, there's a new dawn and we're going to deal with corruption and so on. And yet you have, you know, Nomvula Mokonyane and co and Esmang Shule, still in government, still in very powerful positions. And frankly, looking like they might take over the party after the election.
They're the tail wagging the dog.
Yeah. So it's almost like Ramaphosa was put up there as a sort of as a means to win the election.
How, guys? He's got four commissions.
After which he's disposable.
Listen, I think that a lot of people have just, we've given him, what, 2 years now to kind of start figuring out,
year and a half
to start figuring this stuff out. People complain in the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency he's doing nothing. Cyril has had a year and a half, and really there's been very little movement. I don't see much in the way of this international investment that he's seeking coming in. I don't see job creation at all. And in fact, our unemployment statistics seem to be on the rise, not on the decline. There isn't more money in the economy. There's less. There aren't more opportunities for, we were talking about young graduated academics and people who've just got qualifications in the last couple of weeks. What do they have waiting for them in terms of jobs? Are there jobs? It would appear not.
How, guys? Well, he's given you commissions of inquiry. He's given you a commission of inquiry into state capture. He's
I can't
given
tell. You an are, inquiry. Are you being sarcastic? Because, he's given because you these what things. Are these things? These things have no legal power, right, Ivo? I mean, they don't. It's not these people who are being called out in these state commissions of inquiry. They don't necessarily have any effect. They don't have any punch, any bite.
How?
The only people that I've seen that were actually indicted were potential witnesses, you know, that could embarrass the government. Nobody of substance has been charged yet. You know, now that may still happen, but even then, right. I would expect that, you know, there's a few Basasa people and a few minor politicians that aren't sort of really necessary and important in the government anymore. I don't see that Ace Magashula is going to get charged in the next 6 months, for example.
Well, I'm curious then, because this leads to a much bigger question. As we've got the election less than a month away, what can the ANC say that will convert voters? I mean, what can they say to people in Alex, for example? What can the ANC say they've done? Because you usually run on what you've done and then you run on what you're going to do. What do they have to offer at the moment? Cyril's talking about how much he's doing against corruption, but we see more and more corruption uncovered and unveiled every single day, and it doesn't seem to have stemmed the tide at all. There are few improvements in some areas and moderate improvements in others, but it's certainly not a home run for the ANC. So what are they going to promise people, and what are they doing on the campaign trail? How does Cyril kind of go round and have a good story to tell, in inverted commas, that line? You remember that?
Pumia, have you got any ideas?
You're out of ideas then, Ivo. I assume that's a no from
because,
you.
Because no. I don't think that he's actually done anything that he could run on and say, oh, this is what I've done. This is what's worked. And we'll do more of that.
What the ANC have done is
empty promises are easy. I mean, he says, the World Bank's doing business report, right? The ease of doing business in this country, where we ranked 82nd. He says, "Yeah, we want to be under 50th in 3 years' time."
With our labor laws, impossible. You can actually change this, Cyril. You have no intention to, because you're in a marriage of convenience with the unions. And by the way, let's just remember: if you go into a lot of places in South Africa where there aren't resources, there aren't any kind of infrastructural improvements, the first thing people are going to say, if they have read any news at all or paid attention to any of the news, is how could you be a part of a government that allowed the hollowing out of all our state-owned enterprises, that ripped a full third of our GDP out of the economy in corruption, linked to the Guptas and all kinds of other things, Ace Magashule, and God knows at municipal level what the level of corruption might have been. But effectively, thieves who have colluded to rape the state. How did you allow that to happen? Has to be the first question anyone asks him. And he can't sidestep that, can he?
Well, you see, there's other things. There's like Eskom, right? You know, now we've had stage four load shedding for, you know, the worst load shedding we've ever had a couple of weeks ago. And they say, all right, well, they're going to find out what's going on. So Ramaphosa and Pravin Gordhan and so on, they said, no, we're looking into what the problems are at Eskom. I'm thinking, well, what the hell were they doing in the last 5 years? In 2014, Ramaphosa was appointed to head a commission to look into the problems at Eskom.
Right.
5 years later, they say they don't really know what the problems are yet. They're looking into it. Well, what were they doing in those 5 years? And this is Ramaphosa himself. You know, that was his job.
Yeah, he can't say I don't know. He can't say I don't know like he does with everything else there. Pumi, what do you think? I mean, what is the ANC's messaging around this?
You see, and what I find absolutely fascinating about the political landscape right now is we're all between a rock and a hard place, right? So everybody feels that, yeah, so Cyril has been a little bit of a disappointment. You know, mm-hmm. he's been a little bit of a disappointment, but there's a sense that maybe he's a disappointment because he's, you know, sitting there on one bum.
What do you mean? Because he's unstable.
Because he's unstable, you know? Yeah. So maybe what he actually needs is post-election, when he's secured a five-year term, he needs to be given the opportunity to set his government cards. Because essentially, the current Cyril is like Kgalema was. When we got Kgalema, where he, you know, can but can't.
So he doesn't have the full support of the ANC.
So there's a large sense of he needs to be given his due mandate, and then with his mandate, let's see what he's going to do with this. I think I'm very fascinated, and my prediction has been that a lot of people are still going to vote ANC at a national level because they feel that they want to give Cyril a chance, and they want Cyril to have a full mandate, to have a full 5 years, to have his opportunity and show us what he can do. And then I still think a lot of people think that people are going to vote probably smaller party, DA, EFF, at the provincial level because it's closer. I think that there's still a lot of people that are going to vote ANC, even at provincial level, because they want the continuity in place, right? And at municipal level, 2 years from now, we're going to see a vastly different picture, because at the municipal level, it's so much closer to home. It's about my dustbin being taken out. And at that place, I think you're going to find that people are going to vote far more for action-orientated individuals. That's my take. But what Cyril is doing right now is he's doing what all politicians do. You know, he's kind of dancing along with it. And the most fascinating thing for me just moving into the next point around the EFF, as I've always maintained that the role of the EFF has really been to pull the ANC to a left agenda, has mm-hmm. always been to pull the ANC towards the left. Rina and I have had lots of conversations. I've said, I think the EFF is going to go back into the ANC. And I think that the statement by Julius Malema that says, we're going to have to go into a coalition. What they have learned in coalitions without the ANC is that they don't have as much power to push their agenda as they would within a party that's far more left-leaning.
Well, in effect, I mean, Ivo, isn't it also true, to Pumi's point, that the EFF have largely set the agenda for the ANC in the last year?
They have. They've sort of been the revolutionary vanguard in a way. You know, they come out with crazy ideas and see what floats. One of them that did float was expropriation without compensation.
Revolutionary vanguard.
So my point still, and Pumi, you haven't really helped me understand that. There isn't much for him to say other than to just hold the space, because he's got nothing to promise that people believe he will deliver. And everything he's said up to now is about what they could do. But certainly, if you look at his record, he's got nothing to boast about.
But if you understand that for a large majority of the country, what the ANC continues to campaign on is the little things that they do see. So for us sitting out here in Joburg, you know, we see very little movement of the dial. But for people who come from a very low base, they have a hang of a lot more that they're looking at. They're looking at houses that have been handed over to people when they do those door-to-door campaigns. You know, we laughed when we saw the picture of, what's his name, coming out of the shack, right? But I promise you that sitting in that shack, he was saying, do you see those houses that have been built over there? Your turn is coming. Give us the opportunity. Sure. Your turn is coming. They talk about houses, people who have been completely lifted out of poverty because they have now received opportunity to own property which, as our friend Kenton would continue to tell us, gives you the opportunity to create more wealth, right? People have been given education in the number of kids who have been given the opportunity to go to school because they don't have to pay for it is far higher than, and for a lot of people
you
who
mean
are
those
sitting,
schools where 1 in 10 teachers just isn't there anytime.
But if you are sitting in a place where there was no schooling, where what you remember is there was no schooling. Okay, so, now kids get to go to school.
Your
kids
argument,
get uniform. Kids get fed.
Okay. No.
All of those
things. So your argument is in the land of the blind, the one-eyed is king. So be grateful.
Absolutely.
Be grateful, you peasants, for what we've done for you as government. No,
do not be grateful for what we have done. Push us to do more. And that's what they campaign on. So when you say, what are they campaigning on? When he's sitting at the, I mean, I was fascinated to see yesterday's front page of The Star with Helen Ziller. At the trades, I was like, hey, Gok Helen, you came out for this? You shouldn't have come out for this. But you know what? No politician is going to miss an opportunity to stand in front of a crowd. So now blue trains, you know, and we're going to deliver. 3 weeks ago, he was stuck in a train in Pretoria.
Yeah.
But yesterday, he's like, we are delivering 30 trains every month for the next 15 years or whatever it is. You know what I'm saying? All of those things to a voter. When you see the trains arriving, when you see, what's his name, Panyaza Lusufi, saying we are handing over a new school today. We laughed when we saw the video of what's her name going on about combi courts, handing over combi courts, right? Those things, and that's as irritating as it is, and that's why it's so important that civic society must hold its government to account, is the reason these things, the ribbons get cut now. Is because when the ribbons are cut now, 20 days before the election, people go, look what the ANC has done.
Right.
That's why people keep saying to him, on Twitter at least, when, you know, when you see him handing over trains, they're like, how not? You were just talking about 9 wasted years. Here you are cutting ribbons. This didn't happen in the last 18 months. You know what I'm saying? That's why they do that.
Yeah. Ivo, what do you think of that?
I think there's 2 points to be made here. I think the idea that if he gets a strong mandate that he, after the election, will have the power to actually do something, and actually fight against corruption and actually improve service delivery, I think that's very naive. You vote for the ANC, you don't vote for the president. And if you vote for the ANC, well, all you need to do is look at the ANC list and look at the ANC top six and who sits on that list. You've got David Mabuza, you've got Ace Magashula. You know, you got Mokonyane, Kigaba, Mosabenzi Zwane. Those are the people that run the ANC. So the idea that Ramaphosa is suddenly going to have a lot more power after the election, I think is completely untrue. He's not going to have a lot more power. It's going to be the same old ANC running it, except that they now won't have to, be running an election, so they can carry on with their incompetence and their looting. The other thing is, if you're going to campaign on what the ANC has delivered, right, and look, over the last 20 years, it certainly has delivered a lot. Over the last 10 years, much less. But, you know, the ANC can point to, you know, social grants and housing delivery, etc. Just a couple of months ago, the National Assembly agreed to a motion noting that in the Western Cape, the unemployment rate dropped to 19.3%, which is the lowest in South Africa. The expanded unemployment rate is 14 percentage points lower than the national average. It acknowledged that it completed over 200,000 housing opportunities and is on track to meet 100% of its targets by the end of the current term. More than 100,000 people have received title deeds across the province, which exceeds their targets by at least 2,000 every year, not helping people become homeowners. The Assembly recognized that 91.5% of Western Cape households now live within 30 minutes of a healthcare facility. The Assembly congratulates the Western Cape Provincial Government in achieving these massive feats. Now, that's delivery. You know, and if Parliament feels obliged to pass a motion of congratulations to the Western Cape, you know, to actually say that, well, then there's your example. They are obviously doing better than the ANC in where they do govern. And an ANC-run parliament has to admit that. So just running on what they have delivered and so on, you know, on the status quo. Well, look, if people vote for the status quo, then frankly they get the government they deserve.
Yeah. Let's just talk about one of the other small parties at the moment, and we can – round to the EFF again afterwards. But Bantu Holomisa made a very strong statement. He said, not a single party can beat the UDM on ethics and good governance. Well, I think I would have believed him until they joined the EFF and ANC in unseating the mayor of Port Elizabeth and putting that guy in who has subsequently turned out to be a complete crook. I mean, until then, Bantu had a very clean record, and he's not wrong to claim that on ethics and good governance, the UDM have a pretty squeaky clean reputation, but it's also because they don't really have governance anywhere. They're not really in charge of anything. So they're never really entrusted with responsibility. So if you're never given the toys and they don't break, then you can't claim that you didn't break them.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely with you. I think the idea of a coalition, anyone who was thinking of maybe a coalition with the UDM will think twice after what happened in Nelson Mandela Bay. They are clearly not to be trusted, and they will ally with whoever seems politically expedient with them at the time. So I really don't think that there's much to look at there. What's interesting, though, you know, you talk about smaller parties. I wrote a column a few months ago in January, which said, I'm going to hold my nose and vote DA. Right. And my argument was mostly based on the province. You know, I live in the Western Cape, and in the Western Cape, the DA leadership, the DA majority is on a knife edge. And I frankly don't want them to lose that majority because statistically speaking, and I mentioned a few of them earlier, the DA government in the Western Cape has been really good for the province. And I think it would get a lot worse if the ANC took over here. So I'm going to give them my provincial vote. You know, as much as I dislike the sort of the unmoored nature and of the DA at the moment, they don't seem to really have any principles. They're trying to be sort of a mini ANC. But you know, it works. The government works in the Western Cape. Nationally, however, that same motive doesn't really work because the DA will get, I don't know, 18, 20, 22%, depending on which polls you believe. And what exactly they get nationally doesn't really matter. You know, whether they have 20% of the vote or 24%, you know, they're going to have
It's not putting them in power, yeah.
It's not putting them in power. So there's no real threat. You know, where they can push out the ANC, absolutely vote DA. You know, if you think provincially they can do that. But nationally, your options are much more open, which is why I'm going to change my vote and I'm going to vote for the ZSEP, the Capitalist Party. Right? There's a party that actually espouses the ideas that I believe in. I think it'd be great having, even if it's just one member of parliament, that isn't afraid to stand up and tell them what's what.
So you know, just explain, because you're not involved with the party. You're just like any other voter. Explain why we've had Canthan in here. He's very involved in the party. He's likely to be their number one candidate. Why would you, because a lot of people talk about wasting your vote on a smaller party. Explain again the theory of how nationally it makes a difference to give that vote to a party like the ZACP or the UDM for that matter, rather than to go with one of the three big ones?
Well, the thing is, nationally, you're not wasting your vote. You're denying your vote from the ANC, which is what's important, and you're giving another party, any other party, that vote. So you're basically putting people in parliament that oppose the ANC. So there's no such thing as wasting your vote. In fact, the way our electoral system works is the smaller parties actually have a bit of an advantage. So your vote for a smaller party actually counts a little bit more percentage-wise than it would for a big party.
The weighting.
No, that's the idea that a wasted vote that comes from the DA. The DA are afraid that they're losing votes to smaller parties, you know, because they are a bit unmoored and so on. They've been running one of the most uninspiring election campaigns I've ever seen from them.
That's
DA propaganda.
Yeah, I want to ask Pumi about this. What's your take on smaller parties?
Dude, you know, and Evo's right. The problem with DA's fear mongering is that they're making you think that if you vote for anybody else and not them as an alternative, you're spoiling your ballot, essentially. But it's not. And Eva's point.
Ivo.
Sorry, Baba.
Either way is correct.
Okay, cool. The point is that what you're actually doing, and this is what a lot of people have been talking about, is you are diluting, as it were, the concentration of the ANC. If you vote for a smaller party, the balance is in finding a party that's just small enough, but also big enough to kind of their percentage to make
at least it get even that bigger. Seat
so
or
if,
two, yeah.
You know, if you're voting for, I don't want to name people like, you know, Saudi, for instance.
Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, there's a definite candidate.
It is, considering that what you need, and we were working this out the other day, is you need about 50,000 votes per seat into parliament. So that's what you're kind of trying to weigh up. Is you're going, is my vote adding to make 50,000 to get one person there? Or is it going to be one of 400 votes? Versus if you give it to the ANC, remember that there's the waiting system, first of all, and this is the flaw of democracy, is it's not about the percentage of people who should have voted. It is the percentage of people who did vote.
Right.
So if only 100 people show up, of course, you know, if only 100 people show up and 66 of those people vote for the ANC, the ANC remains with the 2/3 majority. Mm-hmm. So that's what you've got to think about it as. You've got to think about it like that. So say, is my vote adding towards a 50,000 that will get one person from a particular party into there? Or is it going to be one of 400 votes? Or is it one of the 66 that's going to make...
Yeah. And that's exactly my reasoning. I think that it's not unreasonable to think that someone like the Capitalist Party could get 50,000 votes or whatever they do need for at least one person in parliament. They could get a lot more. You know, they seem to be very popular among people who've heard of them.
Let's go back to the ANC for a second and to Ace Magashule. He was speaking at a Chris Hani commemoration yesterday. Now, I think the ANC must be quite judicious about where they deploy Comrade Ace at the moment, but they clearly thought this was an appropriate place for him to be. Here's what he said. He said party members should take lessons from Chris Hani, who always showed respect to the collective views of his party over his own.
He did not.
He did. He added that those who will be deployed to parliament must never use their own consciences in taking decisions, but they must toe the party line.
He's rewriting history here. What we know of Comrade Chris Hani was that he was very vocal about the things that he did not believe in within the ANC. One of which, part of the conspiracy theory that still says that, you know, the Janus Walosh and them were part of a bigger conspiracy, was he was very much against the negotiated settlement. Very vocal about that. So even though he eventually would toe the line, but he was very vocal about the things that he did not believe in, that the ANC leadership
It wouldn't be the first time Ace has rewritten history to suit himself. Yeah,
no, I quite agree. I mean, I remember Chris Hani well, and I remember at the time he was a threat to the negotiated settlement. You know, he's a hardline communist, and. The reason why he was so valuable in the ANC government at the time, and why his assassination was so dangerous, is that he had the support of the disaffected youth, and he was one of the people. There were a few others. Tony Ngeni was one that could basically keep the disaffected youth on side and voting for the ANC. Mm. That was his value there. But he was a hardline communist, and he disagreed with the sort of the neoliberal, if you like, negotiated settlement.
I mean, he disagreed with disbanding an armed struggle.
Yeah.
Very vocally.
So
Sorry, just speaking about commemorating the Chris Hani thing, I read an incredible article in the New York Times penned by, you know, one of our own, Sisonke Msimang, which was about Chris Hani and kind of who Chris Hani was and the meaning of Chris Hani for the youth that Evo talks about that were, cause that's who Sisonke would fall into, that category of people, you know. Very interesting and definitely worth a read. If anybody's out there, look for it in the New York Times.
Okay, very good. He also had this to say. He said, no doubt South Africans would vote for the ANC in their numbers. It's very important that the ANC never really gives individuals credit anywhere or lets individuals shine or lets individuals take responsibility. This is massively important in the ANC. They always talk about in your numbers, as if someone on their own doesn't necessarily get the same amount of attention that if you have, well, you know, 50 friends with you.
That just goes to their ideology, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, you know, toe the party line and so on. It's all about the collective. It's all about what the party says.
And in my view, you know, it's one of their Achilles heels. You know, it's one of the things that makes it that's made them this huge, like, behemoth of a thing that makes individuals. Yeah, it makes individuals feel.
That's also why.
Sorry, Eva, you were breaking up a little.
Sorry, that's also why I don't buy this idea that Ramaphosa is going to deliver us the new dawn. We're not voting for Ramaphosa. We're voting for the ANC. Mm. We're voting for the NEC. We're voting for the collective. And what will happen is what the collective does. And frankly, the collective has a dreadful record.
Mm. And they want you to buy into is that it's not so much about the individuals. It's about policies. It's about the policies that they're supposed to be pushing. It's about the party line is what policies are. Unfortunately, they're not showing us a lot of how much that party line is actually sold down the line. You know, so you see there is a party line, there is a manifesto, but when people are out there talking, you know, they forget some of the talking points that are in that party line.
Well, they also forget that the ANC still every year as Congress it adopts the National Democratic Revolution, which was adopted by the ANC in 1969. It was written in 1962 by the South African Communist Party, right? And that is a plan for socialism in this country. Now, the ANC can say what it likes to business people and to investors and to, you know, professionals that are thinking of leaving the country. Ultimately, it goes back to the National Democratic Revolution. That is their policy, and that is a policy of socialism. And Ace Magashule is not wrong. He says it is about the collective. That's exactly their policy. And people should realize that, you know, that is what the ANC stands for. You know, they don't stand for more investment and more growth and individualism, and then they don't.
It's worth noting and reflecting on something that I saw Mike Schussler tweet, The Economist, just a little while ago, about the business confidence index at the moment. Now, if we take a mean as being kind of what we were going through around 2010, that was when business confidence was reasonable. It was much, much higher in 2004, 2006, 2007. It is currently at an all-time low in terms of the percentage of businesses who believe the political climate is a constraint rather than something that we can use to our advantage. The points, they're very, very low indeed on the index, which has a maximum of like 80, 90, 100. We're sitting around currently 14%. And the total business confidence, which is, of course, buoyed by a lot of people who are in corporate in corporate businesses that have relationships with government, so that would be a bit higher. That's close to, on the same scale, around 31%, somewhere around there. But these are not high numbers. They're actually the lowest they have been since 1994. That tells you something.
Yes. No, it is. And there's a whole bunch of economic indicators that are extremely negative, and business confidence is one of them. You know, the only people that are confident about investing in this country are people that know that they can do a sweetheart deal with the ANC. You know, I see Nissan has just said they're gonna build a new Navara in South Africa, which is worth about 3 billion rand in investment or something. That's great, but then they have the whole the subsidy program, the motor vehicle subsidy program, to rely on. You know, if you can rely on something like that, you know, or you can rely on Eskom's emergency, for example, to make you money, then there's still money to be made in South Africa. There's always money to be made in a crisis.
Yeah, but to go back general business,
you know, your average small and medium size business in this country, they are under the whip, and they're absolutely not confident of the future.
Just to go back to the EFF for a moment, what Julius Malema actually said there, and it's quite an interesting point of view, because I think what he's doing is he's saying to his voters, there's a gun to your head. If you don't vote for us, we'll be forced into coalitions with the ANC. Now, that's a very clever mind trick to play, a Jedi mind trick to play on your supporters, because you're saying to them, you don't like the ANC, that's why you're voting EFF. That's the primary reason the EFF exists. It exists as a political home for people like Julius who were kicked out of the ANC, right? That's their genesis. But for a lot of EFF supporters, they don't want them. Their primary objective is to not have the ANC involved. They'd like the EFF to make the decisions. So Julius is kind of forcing their hand here, right?
Yeah, I'm not really sure that I understand that, because either way, you know, the EFF's best future is in coalition with the ANC. That's the way in which they can be kingmakers, where they can pull the strings. You know, if the ANC has to basically keep the EFF on side, if the ANC has an outright majority or, you know, a two-thirds majority or whatever, the ANC can do what it wants and doesn't need to care about what the EFF does or says.
But what do you think an EFF supporter, not Julius or Floyd, a normal supporter might feel about an ANC coalition?
Well, as long as the ANC toes the EFF line like they do on EWC, I think EFF supporters would be happy with that. If they can pull the ANC to the left, you know, into a more revolutionary organization or more hardcore socialist organization, I think they'll feel that they're achieving something.
Yeah, I mean, Pums, what do you think if EFF voters are thinking?
You know, I'm always in two minds, because with all of the information that we have at hand, we're able to make lots of different kinds of inferences. And I like to kind of go back to where the average voter sits. And South African voters are incredibly politically astute. You know, we know a lot. We know a lot in terms of what's happening on the ground and where people are and where people are at. And again, it's why I think that at the national level and largely provincial level, people are still going to vote the way that they've always voted. And it's going to be at the municipal level that people are going to start. Because at the municipal level, it's where you're one-on-one in terms of voting. You know your councillor, you know your ward person, you know those individuals, and whether they're EFF or DA or whatever, you know that, and you know how much action they are able to take. So people are more likely going to vote for that. I think a lot of people who had initially believed in the DA, now that it's eating itself up from the inside, people are probably, the DA, I think, is going to lose a lot of voters to the EFF.
Really?
I do.
Okay.
I think the DA is going to lose voters
DA
to the
EFF.
EFF.
Do you think that too, Ivor?
Well, that wouldn't really make sense, because just ideologically, they are so far apart. For someone to say, okay, well, you know, first they're into free enterprise and equality and tolerance and this, and then they're going to suddenly switch their vote because the DA doesn't deliver, or they feel the DA is losing its way, which is true, they are, that they're suddenly going to switch to a sort of revolutionary fascist communist organization doesn't really make sense to me. It'll be more indirect. You know, I think there might be some ANC voters that switch to the EFF and some DA voters that switch to the ANC on a national level. That might be true, but I think the DA will lose a lot more to the smaller parties. You know, they'll lose votes to the Freedom Front Plus, to COPE, to the UDM, hopefully to the Capitalist Party.
So, Ivo, what about municipal level? Let's go to that, because Pumi raised the question. Let's look at places like Alexandra Township at the moment, which has become one of the focal points of electioneering, and electioneering that is really disruptive to people's lives. And I understand that the political parties are fighting hard for their own survival in places like Alex. But it's really, this is a DAANC situation, and it's been made up. It's not as if Alex was a paradise 5 years ago and suddenly it's a problem because Herman Mashaba is mayor. And it's also not true to say that the DA have done a terrific job in Alex of all places over the last 2 years, like perhaps they have done in the Western Cape. So what do we make of this made up outrage and controversy that's going on in Alex? And of course people are pissed off and dissatisfied there, but they're no more pissed off and dissatisfied than they were a year ago when Herman wasn't mayor.
Look, I'm kind of jaded about the idea, or cynical about the idea that you know, switching to a DA at municipal level is necessarily going to solve all problems. You know, and I've seen it in my own constituency where I live in Knysna. That there still is, you know, power corrupts, you know,
and absolute power
corrupts absolutely. So, you know, we had the DA take over this town, and there's a whole lot of corruption and shenanigans going on in this town. There's a lot of lack of service delivery. Just the other day, they're switching people to electricity meters, but completely ruining their days. I mean, it's the way they're doing it, basically, they're cutting people off from electricity. So we've got protests almost every day, not just in Knysna, but in the Garden Route in general. So thinking that the DA is going to be like this magic, you know, oh, we'll solve
silver
everything.
A
silver bullet. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think in some places it will work, in other places it won't. And in some places what will work is, you know, for the first 5 or 10 years, they're great because, you know, they're just new in government and they've got ideas and so on. But you've got to watch them. You know, you've got to watch that they don't degenerate into the same sort of corruption that you see so often see with the ANC. So it's definitely not a silver bullet. You know, I can say at provincial level that the DA is doing a reasonable job. At municipal level, I've seen some DA-run municipalities that are, frankly, poor. You know, whether they're on average as poor as ANC municipalities, I'm not sure. But, you know, I think people need to hold their municipal governments, you know, to account far better.
The politicians need to be watched very carefully at all times. We can't just...
Yeah, that's about right. No one's going to dispute that. So, Ivo and Pumi and everybody else, this is an interesting thing. I followed Davi Skoltz, who's a management consultant, but he also is a bit of an election nerd, and he tweets some very interesting by-election results. I don't know that any of us are that interested in by-elections, but maybe this will grab your attention. So yesterday they had some by-elections. Everything feels, according to Davi, a little bit like the 2016 voting pattern, which is not great for the ANC. They're at serious risk in Gauteng, according to these by-elections. The DA looking good to hold the Western Cape. Conservative Afrikaans voters are drifting from the DA to the Freedom Front. And KZN, as usual, is all over the place, he says. So a couple of those municipalities, Chris Hani Municipality in Mpumalanga, is up to 87% for the ANC. That's another 7 points up for them. In KZN, the ANC gaining 5 points, 49%. In the Abakuluzi Municipality and Salplaiki, which is in the Northern Cape, has gone also in the ANC's direction, 42%, which is up another 7 points. So those are some interesting results for the ANC. Those are the good results for them. In Rand West City in Gauteng, the DA gained 5 points to get to 50%. And the ACM, which is, you know, that's Claudie's people, right? They went, they got 1% in the Rand West City municipality.
Claudie with the chance of madness.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, no, indeed. Look, I think you'll find, just like you find disaffected voters on the right that are going to smaller parties and switching to the EFF, the EFF Plus.
Mm-hmm.
You find the same on the left, and you know, people like the BLF and the ATM and the and the AC and the ACM, they actually do find some voters, mostly people who obviously who expect to get rich on tenders. But you'll find they probably will you know snaffle up a percent or two of the vote.
Yeah, I think a lot of people be curious about George, which is right next door to where you live, Ivo. In George, apparently the DA went down to 73%, which is 19 points down. That's quite a big drop for them. And the Freedom Front Plus gained 14 points. So there you can see a direct transfer of DA voters into the FF Plus.
Yes, I think that's actually happening. A lot of DA voters, especially DA voters on the right. Now, with the right, there's two types of right people. I mean, there's the classical liberals, you know, who want property rights and freedom of expression and tolerance and equality and so on. And then there's your more sort of traditional conservatives, your Afrikaners, if you like. And I think the DA is losing both of those groups to some extent, because they have to appeal to a broad church, and they call themselves a broad church,
like the ANC.
Yeah, like the ANC.
Exactly. They have to appeal increasingly to the left, right? Which is why they had that fight about BEE and Musi saying, "Well, no, we can carry on. We still think that black is a proxy for disadvantage."
You see, Ivo, for me, the thing about the DA is that it has, and it's South Africa as a whole. There are two types of voters, right? There are ideological voters and they are racial voters. And what I mean by racial is what you're talking about, Ivor, that says they are in the white vote. They are the conservative and then they are liberal.
Mm.
Similarly, in the black vote, right? They are the conservative and they are the liberal, but also there is a huge, racial burden that we also have to contend with, right? So people who have overcome the racial issue of voting for the DA, even though it is still historically seen as a white party, people who've overcome that racial burden went into the DA with the hope that the DA would be different from the ANC and deliver differently. But they still look for the same things. They still look for the same things that the party must deliver on.
Mm-hmm.
And why I then believe a lot of people are going to leave the DA and go to the EFF is because they are racial voters. They are not going to vote for another white party. And they are not going to vote for the ANC. So who are they going to give their vote to? They are going to give their vote to the EFF.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, the complexity of how we vote is very much steeped in who we are. And the racial aspect of it cannot be discounted. So where the white voters are also going to make a decision in terms of, am I going to vote for a black party like the ANC, or am I going to vote for another white party? You know what I'm saying? They are those that are making that decision too. They are ideological voters who are going to go, what I believe in the DA is vastly different to what the EFF say they stand for. Therefore, the closest place for me to go to is either the ANC or the VF.
What? Yeah, Freedom Front.
Freedom Front Plus. You know, that's the thing. That's what we're seeing. And unfortunately for the DA, which is why I think they're just scoring fucking own goals right now, is they are not, they don't seem to have any ideology that is strong enough to make anyone of any of those people that are sitting on the fence jump to their defense, right? And people are disgruntled. So you are sitting in a municipality where you're saying, this bloody DA, you know, is no different. They're just a bunch of politicians politicking, you know? And so you also have to make that kind of a decision around them, you know?
Yeah, I think that's where the South African electorate needs to mature. And I think a lot of us, you know, back in the days when we were negotiating the new South Africa, you know, the Rainbow Nation, et cetera, were hoping that would happen faster, that people would vote on ideological principles, rather than vote on racial identity. You know, identity politics, I think, is evil. It's evil around the world. Identity politics is what gets you into wars and stuff. And I think people were hoping that more people would vote on ideology and principle. And it's happening a lot more slowly than we'd all hoped.
Is it really much slower? I mean, we've only had 5 voting chances, you know? Only 5.
No, that's true. But
and looking at
years.
Myself,
I mean, that's a generation, you know.
But speaking of that's a generation. So looking at myself, the number of times that I have been able to vote, really, I'm only just beginning to get to grips with what that voting is about and how you make that decision and the things that you have to consider and I am a person that. Absolutely cares. Even as we then have conversations about the past, when we talk about a Chrisandi, I mean, I was 10 years old when the man died. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But there are people today who have to vote who are not even that old, you know, who don't know this person that we are talking about, who don't understand this thing, but also understanding that the politicians that we are dealing with and the electoral that we're dealing with, all of these things it's shifting sands that are so mired in so much of our past, even though we're hoping for a better kind of future. You know what I'm saying? So the parties themselves haven't matured into that space either.
No, I think a lot of the parties rely on that legacy stuff.
Yes.
They haven't matured either. So the electorate.
You know, it makes sense that people who are pretty much older than I am, you know, I was a student when we negotiated the new South Africa, you know, between 89 and 94. I started working in 93. So people my age and older would remember apartheid and would remember, you know, what it was like and so on. And I kind of, it doesn't surprise me that they would vote along racial lines, you know, or at least along communities, so group lines.
Yeah, because that fear is still very palatable to them. You know, we kind of don't remember the brutality.
But now take someone who's 20 years younger and who doesn't remember apartheid personally. You know, they were born in the early 90s or late 80s, early 90s. They never saw apartheid for themselves. All they saw and grew up with as children was Mandela and Mbeki. You know, that you'd think that they would vote more on actual issues, on actual service delivery, on you know, issues like corruption. And yet, I still see a lot of those people still voting along racial lines, on the basis that, well, the ANC is the party of liberation and we're never going to abandon them.
Mm. All right, Ivo, I'm afraid we're out of time, but that was, I think, very exciting hour that we've spent talking about all these things, and we've probably gone for another 3 hours if you let us, but we have to call it to a close. Thank you so much for joining us, Ivo Fechter. You can read his columns in various publications, and don't expect anything that isn't controversial from Ivo, right?
Oh, yeah, thanks very much, Gareth.
Good
nice
morning.
To talk to you, as always. Thank you, Pumi. Pumilele Mashiro, who's been with us from 6 o'clock this morning. Thanks for some interesting insights, both of you. That is The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's every single Thursday. All the current affairs information you need to know if you want to sound like you know anything at the coffee machine today. Thank you very much. That's all we got time for today. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day in the company of cliffcentral.com. Mm-hmm. Bunch of really good shows coming up, including The Unview with Alan Ford. They're going to be talking about everything in live theater, and they've got Monte Cassino popping by for that too, so don't miss any of that.
Go and be great.
All right, Pums?
Go and be great today.
Thank you very much. There we go.
This is cliffcentral.com.